Is everybody, can everybody hear me? I'm sorry about the slightly chaotic nature of this first lecture. There is an overflow lecture theatre on the other side of the road if there's not enough space up there. I'm really sorry about the slightly chaotic nature of this first lecture, but I feel I have to start. Can I welcome everyone here and thank you very much for coming to this lecture. This is the first of lectures I'll be giving across this term and next term. Can I especially welcome all the students who are new to the LSE? The LSE may not be physically the most beautiful place in the world, intellectually it is the best, and I hope for those who haven't been here for long that you'll really enjoy your stay in the intellectual community. Can I just say about these lectures, I intend this, as it were, as a genuine lecture course. Therefore, there is a reading list, which I hope everyone here either has a copy of or we are able to get to see a copy of. This lecture course is designed primarily, really, for first-year undergraduates and master's students, so I hope it's accessible more or less to everybody. Sorry, there's a crowd disturbance up the top there. These lectures are not simply sociology lectures, although I'm a sociologist by profession. They are designed to appeal to anyone with an interest in the social sciences. As you'll see from the topic, what I plan to discuss is essentially the role of politics in the modern world following the collapse of socialism and the collapse of communism. To do this, however, we have to go back before the origins of these political ideologies. I don't know how many... Do you think you could shut the door at the top there at some point so it would get a bit peace and quiet? Don't know how many people here get The Guardian, but you might have seen this yesterday. I don't know if you know who this is. Mick Jagger, the most famous alumnus of the LSE. Well, he's back, according to The Guardian. Karl Marx is back. I'd like to suggest to you in these lectures that Karl Marx never went away, because what Marx was very good at doing as diagnosing the problems of global capitalism. He wasn't so good, for reasons I'll try and show, at suggesting solutions. But everybody's surely conscious that we do live at a phase of another global crisis of capitalism. And Marx's ideas are certainly relevant still to how we might analyze that, although I don't believe Marx is back in the sense that there can be any reversion to socialism or communism, because our experiences of those have proved how limited and problematic they are. So now we have to look for something else. The point of these lectures really is to ask what else we should be looking for and what feasible politics we can produce. Let me just, if you don't mind, just spend a couple of minutes going through this book list, so I hope that everyone's got access to a copy. There are people up there who don't have access to one at all. Is there someone down here who could take some up? Because there are plenty.
Do you think you could just take one first? Just see if there's someone outside. There should be someone outside the room.
Should be someone just outside there who would just take them up. This is still the age of primitive technology, I suppose, but... if you don't mind, even if people haven't got them, I just start and buzz through pretty quickly. What I'll be doing is spending at least a couple of lectures discussing the nature of Marx's ideas and the impact of Marxism. You can't understand why the Soviet Union died, why Marx has suddenly become a sort of obsolescent figure, unless you know what Marx and Marxism were all about in the first place. Really, Marxism was the central inspiration of socialism, not just of communism. Marxism lay at the origins of most of the reformist labor parties in Western Europe, not just of communist parties in Eastern Europe. absolutely essential to understand that. So I'll be spending at least a couple of lectures discussing Marx and his legacy, and also analysing what went wrong, why the Soviet Union collapsed, and where this leaves us with regard to the rest of the world. The first book's down here then, if you turn to page one where it says Director's Lectures there. Let me just buzz through quickly and tell you which are the most useful books. I would like people who follow this course to try and do a bit of reading for it. These are generally available books. David McLeod on the top one is probably the most useful general book for understanding Marx's ideas. And it's a very useful, easy introduction, non-problematic, non-ideological introduction to Marx. There's a tremendous amount of dross on Marx, as you can imagine, but this is a fairly sensible, balanced thing. The Elster book, the second one, is more difficult. If anyone's interested in the history of Marx and Marxism, it is, however, a good book, but I wouldn't read it until you've read the McClellan book. The Chris Pearson book, The Marx Reader, is the best collection of writings by Marx collected together. Marx is one of these people who never finished a book. There are many academics like that. He worked his whole life on a project which he never completed. None of his major books were ever finished, with the exception of the small one, The Communist Manifesto. His major work, Capital, in three volumes, was never finished during his lifetime. So in reading about Marx and Marxism, you have to make use of collections, and this is the most recent collection of writings. Ralph Dahrendorf, next person down here, I hope you will know, was perhaps the most celebrated director of the LSE during the post-war period, and I suppose someone I would take as my role model, because he not only tried to run the LSE fairly effectively, but managed to carry on writing and lecturing at the same time. He's one of Europe's most distinguished intellectuals. This is quite a short book on the 1989 revolutions. In case you don't know what the 1989 revolutions were, they were the revolutions that brought down Eastern European communism about, 9 years ago, almost 10 years ago. Fantastic transition in world history, because before that, it looked as though the future belonged to socialism, truly. Even conservatives believe this. After 1989, no one, I think, believes it anymore. This is a great transition in world history. Dahrendorf's book is one of the best short books on why East European communism collapsed, and of course later the Soviet Union became dissolved. Timothy Garton Ash is a part journalist, part academic, teaches in Oxford, played a part in the 1989 revolutions. His writings were widely read through Eastern Europe. His book is again a good commentary on what happened in the 1989 revolutions and after. I hope it, by the way, that everyone is well aware of the momentous implications of 1989, because it's not only the collapse of the Soviet Union, because at the moment we're living through a period when the European Union is just about to absorb several erstwhile East European countries. This is the famous issue of the enlargement of the European Union. It's going to be the biggest change in the history of the European Union so far if countries like Poland, the Czech Republic, maybe one of the Baltic republics, maybe Hungary come into the European Union. Eastern Europe has not gone away. It is still there. And it is not still just like Western Europe. It is not. Anyone who's been to Germany or been to Berlin or maybe comes from Germany, it's a cosmopolitan audience, will know that East Berlin is still not like West Berlin. You don't make a transition overnight from a different kind of culture, different kind of mentality, different kind of system to a Western market society. These are real living issues. Kalinikos's book, The Revenge of History, is written by someone who still believes that socialism is a relevant project for the 20th century. And he's a good writer. It's worth a look, but it's not a beginner's book, really. Later in the course, about the third, fourth lecture, I'll be discussing the development of the global marketplace, the impact of globalization, which in my view lies behind the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the unbelievable transformations affecting our lives today. The debate about globalization is the debate in the modern social sciences. What it is, what it means, what our relationship to the global economy should be, and many other questions. Besides this, the next group of books all discuss the globalization issue. I won't go through all of them. One I particularly recommend is Hurston Thompson, Globalization in Question, which takes a kind of skeptical, jaundiced look at the idea of globalization. That's about the sixth one down. I'd also recommend the book by Professor John Gray, the one above. John Gray is a new recruit to the LSE. He was professor of politics at Oxford. He moved from Oxford to the LSE, part of a general movement, I hope you'll notice, from Oxford to the LSE. LSE being the best. John Gray is a very distinguished writer on political issues. His book has a very interesting reception. This one called False Dawn. It came out about 9 months ago, something like that, in which he said, you cannot live in a world which is dominated simply by a naked global marketplace. It's going to be a very unstable world. Well, many reviewers were very critical of his book, False Dawn. However, I think you can say that a good deal of what he argued subsequently has been proved valid by the immense crisis of the capitalist economy now. I just came back from Asia, and many people here who've just come from Asia will know how significant the crisis is and what a matter of intense debate it is there. It's now affecting everybody. There is a genuine moment in the history of global capitalism which we are experiencing, which could go either way. No one really knows. Peter Dickens' book, Global Shift, just at the bottom of that block of books, is a very good empirical discussion of globalization. Has very good stuff on the large corporations. It shows that globalization is indeed a reality. Our world is different from the world of 25, 30 years ago. What made the difference is largely the impact of modern mass communication systems, electronic communication, created modern global money markets, enabled businesses to shift around the world with great rapidity. It's changed the whole structure of the world economy. He's very good on these things. The next block I'll be talking about significance of the idea of risk, the risks we face, not just from the global economy, but ecological risk in the late 20th century. The second block of books, four of them, are analyses of this issue. The one I'd most recommend is Ulrich Beck, the top one, Risk Society. Ulrich Beck, that's the top of the second block of books on the second page, Risk Society. Ulrich Beck argues that we're moving away from a world dominated by industrialism, industrial society, to what he calls risk society. Risk society is a society subject to rapid and unforeseen changes of the kind which you could say have now affected East Asia, for example. One moment the Asian societies are a miracle, next moment they're a disaster. That cannot both be true. But that is the kind of world that Ulrich Beck says we're living in. Ulrich Beck has also joined the LSE, at least as a visitor coming for one term a year. He'll be here in the second term this year, and I strongly recommend that if you're at all interested in the themes of these lectures, you attend whatever lectures he might give. He's one of the great figures in European social thought of the moment. I'm very pleased that he's spending part of the year at the LSE. Another interesting book at the bottom is Bill McKibben, The End of Nature. The end of nature is not the end of the physical world. Sorry, this microphone is blanking out slightly. The end of nature is not the... seems to depend where I stand. I fall off the edge here. The end of nature is not the end of the physical world, obviously. It's the end of a world which is uninfluenced by human intervention. Meaning there are very few aspects of nature which are any longer natural because human beings have so thoroughly intruded themselves into them. The BSE episode is a kind of prototypical example of this, but it also applies to the human body. Much of what happens to us as individuals is no longer natural. You only have to think of reproductive technologies to see that in our time You can have a child, for example, with no sexual encounter at all between the individuals involved because of storage possibilities and reproduction technologies. This is not nature. Whatever it is, it's not nature. It's a massive change in our way of life. Bill McKibben's book is an easily accessible discussion of what the end of nature means. It's the key to ecological thinking, really. The next group of books all about democracy, and I'll be discussing the spread of democratization worldwide, what it means. I just came back from China, where there is, of course, a contentious history of democracy, but democracy is a universal idea in the 20th century. Well, it wasn't previously. Almost everybody was anti-democracy in the 19th century. It's become so familiar that everybody now is a Democrat that we've sort of forgotten that history. Most people, especially most conservative parties, were strongly hostile to the idea of democracy in the 19th century and indeed through into the 20th century. Democracy, however, is the idea, in a way, of the 20th century. The best thing to read here is the second book down, David Held, Models of Democracy. David Held, Models of Democracy. It's a very good, easily understandable discussion of debates about democratic theory and practice. If you're interested in sort of issues of the moment, one of these is The End of History. And if you look under fourth one down, Francis Fukuyama, The End of History, deservedly famous book. The end of history doesn't mean the end of change. It means the end of historical alternatives. Communism has collapsed. Fascism is largely a memory, certainly in Europe. There seem to be no grand historical alternatives anymore. That's what Fukuyama means by the end of history. The end of dramatic change, all we seem to have left is capitalism coupled to parliamentary democracy. Do we? Well, that's the question I'll be asking and trying to answer. Finally, in the last couple of lectures, I'll be discussing where we are now. That is, do the categories of right and left still make any sense? Relate to a globalized marketplace? What kind of politics should we be in the future? Is it possible to have some kind of global governance? Should we be aiming for global governance? Is this an impossible ideal? The kinds of issues I'll be talking about. If you're interested in sort of Britain, the best book is Will Hutton, The State We're In, famous book about the problems of British society and what kinds of political reforms are necessary. For a book of general interest, I'd recommend Skidelsky at the bottom, The World After Communism. Skidelsky and I have somewhat different political position, but this is a very, to my mind, illuminating discussion of the consequences of the collapse of communism. Don't think the collapse of communism is something in the past. It's integral to the current world crisis. Anyone who's been following the world crisis will know that it was a sequence of events which moved from Asia to Russia, and will know that in Russia, the idea that you could simply make a rapid transition from consolidated communist economy and society to a market society through the introduction of sheerly economic change, this has proven to be an illusion. What has emerged in Russia is at best a form of gangster capitalism, which is highly unstable. What has emerged is a system of proto-democracy rather than elaborated parliamentary democracy. And this is not just their problem, it is our problem. In an era of globalization, there's a key sense in which we're all in it together, in which what happens in one area of the world immediately affects what happens to us in our particular corner of it. Let me spend the rest of this first lecture just identifying the main problems and issues of the course. This course is essentially about the impact. I have to get this right, because there's only a bit of the page you can write on with this high technology. About the impact of modernity in the world. Modernity sounds like a complex term, but it isn't. Modernity means the rise and global impact, the rise and global impact of Western industrial civilization, which initially developed in one small corner of the world, Western Europe, from about the 17th and 18th centuries onwards. Western Europe, remember, was a barbaric corner of the world in the 17th century. Excuse me, it was well behind Chinese civilization, for example, in terms of its level of economic development, technology, and culture. During a period of only something like 200 years, the whole world has come to be dominated by the Western industrial model. This is the background to all political discussion, as well as social scientific discussion. The amazing spread of Western styles of life, Western industrial culture, industrial society to become the first global society. For better or for worse, that's what it is. That's what it's become in the 20th century. There is nothing like this previously in history. All the main terminologies of politics, including conservatism, socialism, liberalism, they all take their meaning from the evolution, the early evolution of Western industrial society. Marx and Marxism also took their point of departure from the early evolution of modern industrial society. Modernity, then, is a series of economic, political, and cultural institutions developing in Western Europe from something like the 17th and 18th centuries onwards, but now in the 20th century becoming truly global in their impact. Now, if you look at the course of history, you might think, and many history books would say, that history is a progressive process. That if you look back in the history of Western Europe and so forth, that history would sort of look like a line like that, of like increasing technological, political, cultural progress. History does not look like that, and this is a sort of key starting point for these lectures. History instead looks more, this is a human global history, looks more like this. For a long period, probably 90% of the time that human beings have been on the earth, human beings lived in small hunting and gathering societies. There was very little economic development. Things stayed pretty stable for many thousands of years. At a certain point, about 5,000 or 6,000 years ago, nobody knows the reason, you got a big break in history, an acceleration of social change. This was the period dominated by the great civilizations of traditional China, of Rome, of Greece, and a few other major civilizations. No one knows where they came from, but they changed the pattern of history. They were city-based civilizations. There was a fair development of trade and marketing, and they invented war, warfare. Modern warfare, anyway, dates from these early civilizations. They broke the course of history. They introduced a dynamism into history which it didn't previously possess. They had writing. Writing was a medium of power. Early societies did not possess the means of writing. Writing did not emerge as a way of telling stories. Writing emerged as a way of storing goods. It was a notation system. That's how it emerged. Writing provided the basis of increased organizational power. Organizational power made the early civilizations possible. Greece and Rome were something, the Mesopotamian civilizations, previously unseen in history. They were much more dynamic than anything that went before. But when you compare them to this, you're talking a tiny slither of history from roughly 17th to the 18th centuries onwards. You're talking about the period marked by the emergence of modernity in Western Europe. Western Europe, rest of the world, there have been more changes in the last 200 or 300 years than there have been in the whole previous period of world history. That's why the era of modernity is simply different. It is not just an extension of past history. It is not just one more civilization after these other civilizations. Modernity introduces a level of change totally unprecedented in history. The speed of change becomes much greater. scope of change, how many people it affects, and like the intensity of change, how much it affects people's everyday lives. Totally different from previous agrarian civilizations. So when you're talking about the last 200 or so years, you are talking like a sort of grand historical human experiment. No one has lived before in the way in which we're trying to live now. So many of the risks and dangers, as well as the benefits of our world, stem from the fact that this is something quite new in human history. You can't understand modern politics, indeed, you can't understand the social sciences, if you don't understand the radically innovative character of Western industrial society. It has something, we have to work out what that something is, but it had something which simply allowed it to sweep all the other cultures away. The last 200 years has been a massive process of cultural destruction, linguistic destruction across the world as Western industrial culture conquered it. Conquered it in a way which no previous civilization managed. That's why globalization is so important to this discussion. Previous civilizations always lived along with other civilizations. Chinese civilization, for example, the biggest and best ever, only occupied one part of the world. Was not really in contact with the other major civilizations, only very marginally. Things are completely different for us today. We're continually in contact with people on the other side of the world. Globalization is somehow built into the very nature of modernity and is the backdrop to the evolution of modern politics and modern social scientific thinking. Now, the driving motors of modernity, the driving forces involved, I think are by now fairly well known. There are two sets of revolutions which occurred, roughly speaking, in the late 18th century in Western Europe and spreading then to what became the United States. The terms are familiar, but I'd ask you to look at them in a rather different way from usual. The first is the impact of industrial revolution, and the second is the impact of political revolution. Industrial revolution transformed the face of Europe, but the Industrial Revolution is not to be understood as simply technology. Industrial Revolution is not just like little children pulling carts through mines or the invention of spinning jennies or that kind of thing that you see in the history books. Of course, these were important, but Industrial Revolution was about a shift in the total way of life, really, from one type of society to another, from an agrarian, pre-modern society to a modern industrial one. And it's relatively easy to see how significant and massive this shift was. If you consider, for example, the proportion of people living in cities compared to those living in rural areas before the Industrial Revolution and after. In the pre-modern civilizations like Greece and Rome, I mean, you know, everyone associates Rome with the city Rome and so on. They were city-based civilizations, Rome and traditional China and so forth. But in none of these civilizations did more than 10% of the population live in cities. Pre-modern civilizations were overwhelmingly agrarian civilizations. 90%, usually 95% of the population lived and worked from the land. The influence of the city was therefore relatively confined. Industrial Revolution completely changed this. Key part of the Industrial Revolution is transition, therefore, from people working on the land to working in manufacture and industry and living in the rural areas and instead living in urban ones. This is the extraordinary transformation. Now, by most estimates, depending on what you count as a city, in most Western countries, 90% of the population live in cities and urban areas. Almost complete reversal of the past. If you look at one of the most interesting indices of this change, especially if you compare industrial society now with pre-modern society, it's in agriculture itself. Throughout most of human history, and this is still true in large parts of the world, people had to labor from the land to sustain themselves with the basic means of food and provision for their material needs. This is the history of humanity. Peasant production, working from the land, village life, true of probably half the world still. But in the industrialized countries today, only 1.5% of the labor force works in agriculture. Extraordinary, amazingly, tiny proportion of the labor force is in agriculture. And that 1.5% produces more than we can consume. Therefore, the European Union pays farmers still to produce more than is actually bought by the people consuming the food. That's the origins of butter mountains and wheat mountains and so forth, protection of the farming sector. 1% of the occupational structural labor market could easily produce enough food, not just for everybody in the West, but probably in principle for most of the population of the world. Is extraordinary turnaround. Modern societies are no longer agrarian societies, they're no longer rural societies, and they're no longer based on agricultural production. It's a fantastic change in human history because it means that all of us, in some sense, have to sell our labor power for a living. In the past, everyone had a kind of plot of land, you know, that they lived in, on, and they worked from. That was their livelihood. We have nothing. We only have our labor power. That's why you come to university. When you leave university, you will be, in effect, selling your skills, which we hope will be very, very well-developed skills from the LSE. You will be selling these skills to an employer. You will be, that is what we mean by a labor market. There was no labor market, basically, in pre-modern societies. All this is a creation of the last 200 or so years. Industrialization also dramatically affected communication. When you think of industrialization, don't just think of the actual production system. The Industrial Revolution transformed communications. The history of modernity is in large part the history of the conquest of time and space, the transformation of time and space. And the Industrial Revolution basically created communication systems where you don't need to be present with the other person to communicate with them. You would be amazed how long it took for news to percolate from one part of the world to another in the world before the late 18th century, early 19th century. It would take months and months for news, for example, to get from what was then small New York to London. It would take ages and ages for such news to percolate. The key thing was the invention of the Morse code in the 19th century, product of industrial innovation. For the first time in human history, you could communicate with people instantaneously, more or less, without being in the same physical milieu. The only way you could do it previously was by primitive means like the semaphore or smoke signals or going there on a fast horse, whatever it might be. This is one of the biggest transitions in human history is the invention of remote communication systems. Our whole world depends upon communication with people. We not only might never have seen, but never will see in our lives. A further aspect of the Industrial Revolution, the industrialization of war, warfare changed its nature from the late 18th century onwards. The prototypical example of this is the machine gun. The machine gun, if you think of the origins of the words, shows you its very name describes what it was about. It was the first time the idea of the machine, the basic sort of means of industrialism, was applied to weaponry. The machine gun destroyed, you could destroy many, many, you could shoot down many people. Previously, you had to load and reload a musket. It might take you 2 or 3 minutes to do that. Before gunpowder, of course, you had other much more primitive means of destroying your enemies or your friends, as the case may be. The invention of mechanical warfare transformed the face of war. The rise of modernity is the rise of the era of mass warfare. in which for the first time millions of people have been killed in war. I raise this in a course on politics because it is crucial to it. Many of the political changes which have affected our lives in the 20th century have been shaped by war and by the experience of mass modern war. A very good example is the welfare state, for instance. The welfare state has a longish history, but the welfare state as we know it was created after the Second World War and as part of the experience of that war. It created a world where people felt they owed things to other people and they had a kind of wartime spirit in this country. That's what made the welfare system possible. It affected democracy because the extension of democracy was also influenced by war. Women, as most people here will know, women were not regarded as citizens in the early development of democracy. They're simply left outside. Women and often non-whites were left outside both the theory and practice of democracy. Well, women became voters in quite a number of Western countries through war. In the First World War, to some extent in some countries in the Second World War, states needed women to take part in the economic effort and more generally commit themselves to the war effort. That was part of the reason that women got the vote, that they were needed in this way. Of course, there were pressure groups pushing for this on the part of women and so forth, but very much again bound up with the history of warfare. You can't understand the evolution of modern society or modern politics without giving the factor of warfare its due role, and this means special industrialized warfare. Mass war dates only really from the 19th rather than the 18th century. It's generally agreed that the first mass war was the American Civil War. In the American Civil War, far more people lost their lives than had done in any previous conflict which we know of. Mechanized weaponry was quite widely used for the first time in the American Civil War. It wasn't yet completely widespread. That's the Industrial Revolution. It was the kind of, you know, the main motivating vehicle of the transformative dynamic nature of Western society. The second is political revolution. We've become so accustomed, I think, to the idea of political revolution that it seems as though it's always been around, but it hasn't. We become so used, as I mentioned, to the idea of democracy that it seems as though it's always been around, but it hasn't. Both these things were largely new from the late 18th century onwards. The idea of democracy, for example, has classical Greek roots, goes back 2,000 years as a notion, but this was never democracy as we now understand it. Democracy in the classical world only applied to a small minority of citizens. The mass of the population were not enfranchised. There was no notion of mass democracy in the classical world. Mass democracy is an invention of our time. It was produced by modernity. When you think of modern civilization, don't just think of the Industrial Revolution. Think of the invention of the modern state, the evolution of modern forms of government. They're all quite different from the forms of government that existed previously, and this applies also to the idea of mass democracy. Revolution is the kind of guiding force of this. Now, historians quite often, I think rightly, draw a distinction between revolution and rebellion. Rebellions have been common throughout history. Rebellions are situations where people mobilize either under the influence of religion or as a form of political protest against the existing regime. So, for example, in medieval Europe, there were many kinds of peasant rebellions. There were peasant movements. They would mobilize against the local aristocracy or gentry, and they often succeeded in bringing down the local lord or sometimes even the monarch himself. Rebellions, therefore, are quite common, but rebellions are quite different from revolutions. In rebellions, what you're trying to do is bring down a particular individual or get rid of a particular disliked policy of the king or the aristocracy. For example, lots of peasant rebellions were about taxation. The peasants wanted mobilized to try to reduce taxation. In rebellions, you have no conception of changing the political system. You are simply trying, as a form of protest, to say, look, this is hurting. Look, you must do something about it. Look, we'd like to get rid of King X and replace him with King Y. Revolution is something new. Revolution involves the idea that you can actively transform an entire system of government and replace it with another one. You can actively transform not just the personnel of government, but the total system of government. And I think you have to say that the era of modernity is the era of revolutions. Medieval times, the era of rebellions. Modernity is the era of revolutions. There have been a successive wave of revolutions over the past 150 or so years. Nearly everyone sitting in this room belongs to a revolutionary society, a society with a revolutionary past. We had the English Revolution of the 17th century, the American Revolution of the 18th century, the French Revolution of the 18th century, and of course you have many socialist revolutions in the 20th century. History of revolution there begins, the most important prototypical revolution is really the French Revolution of 1789, the American Revolution 1776, and the French Revolution 1789, the kind of prototypical early revolutions. In the 20th century, sort of prototypical revolutions have been Russian Revolution of 1917, which initiated Marxist regime, Communist Revolution, China, 1947 or so, initiated a communist regime there, and many other socialist revolutions. Until you get to recent times, then of course you have the 1989 revolutions that I mentioned earlier. In all of these cases, the attempt is not just to supplant individuals, but to change the whole structure of politics. 1789, the French Revolution, made a kind of lasting impact on European and global political consciousness, because 1789, in the most obvious way, overthrew a whole regime. Aristocrats were simply put to death or were banned from involvement in politics. You had, for the first time, a secular, democratic, or democratically inspired regime after the French Revolution of 1789. The French Revolution of 1789 was inspired by the three ideals which still inspire, I think, politics in the 20th century. Freedom. Freedom's something new. People weren't free in feudal times. Freedom is a new value. Individual freedom. Equality. Equality is something new. People were not equal. They were never thought to be equal. They never wanted to be equal in feudal times. Solidarity. We all belong together in the same community. These are the guiding ideals of 1789. They are still the guiding ideals of democratic reform revolution today. So the French Revolution is something new in history. It's just as important as the Industrial Revolution in shaping 20th century world history. It shaped the very framework of modern politics. These two revolutions, which began in the context of Europe, today you have to see have become global. The difference between the 20th century and the 19th and 18th centuries is that this is an era of global industrialization, the spread of industrial production across the world, most recent example being the industrialization of the East Asian economies, coupled to the global spread of democracy. There are only about two countries in the world which don't now declare themselves to be democracies. Of course, we might disagree about whether they're truly democracies, but nevertheless, everybody now proclaims democracy as their guiding ideal. Nobody did in the 19th century, or only maybe the Americans and the French did, hardly anyone else did, and certainly not in the 18th century. And when you look at the origins of European socialism, European communism, the ideas of Marx himself, they took their inspiration from the conjunction of the two great revolutions. Marx lived from 1818 to 1883. He therefore lived through the period at which the first impact of industrial and political revolution was making itself felt. The idea of socialism and also the idea of communism first appear in the early 19th century. They did not exist before. They were responses to the impact of the twin revolutions. Like other socialists, Marx asked the question, what were the origins of these revolutions? How come they're so dynamic? How come they're changing the world? What future do they hold for us? That's the texture out of which the idea of socialism emerged, and I'll be pursuing that next week, so I hope to see you under slightly less chaotic circumstances a week from now.